Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider. We'll get started right after this.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This exit poll is right, Andrew. I will publicly eat my hat on your programme.
I won't eat my hat, but I will eat my kilt if they get
50. We're running out of hats
here.
That's a hat and a kilt. Right.
Paddy Ashdown and Alistair Campbell on the night of the election in May 2015. Ed Miliband is all but flicking through the John Lewis catalogue and picking out Farrow and Ball paint swatches for the flat above Downing Street. For weeks, every poll had predicted a Labour victory. Every poll except the one that mattered.
But here you see the Conservatives up 9, an improvement on 2010.
As Miliband was literally writing his victory speech and that exit poll dropped, a member of his team walked in. They said, "Don't worry, the poll's wrong."
Friends, this is not the speech I wanted to give today, because I believed that Britain needed a Labour government. I still do, but the public voted otherwise.
I've just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a majority Conservative government.
In the aftermath, Paddy Ashdown, the former leader of the Lib Dems, would spend weeks trying to fend off attempts to get him to fulfil his promise and eat his hat. One BBC producer even tracked down a marzipan-flavoured hat to make it easier on his digestion. Every election, we follow the exact same cycle. For months, we go on about this poll and that poll, who's up and who's down. Which policies the polling shows people really care about, and which they could really do without. But there are caveats.
There have been lots of polls over the last year. There'll be hundreds more polls. The only one that matters is the one when the general election comes.
My message to every single Labour Party member, every single MP, every single candidate is ignore that poll.
Still, we follow the pollsters like soothsayers whispering in the shadows about what's going to happen at the election. And this year has been no different.
With the Prime Minister already facing a potential revolt, he's now been dealt another blow with some sensational new polling out this morning.
Day after day, week after week, poll after poll, we've been told just how unpopular Rishi Sunak is. But as his Aussie campaign chief Isaac Levito told him a few months ago, if the Tories can start to narrow that gap before they finally call an election, they might still be able to pull it off. In a country of 60 million people, with 45 million registered voters, tracking down who might vote for you and why they're willing to put an X next to your party's name at the ballot box is an essential and lucrative art form. And there is so much of it around these days. There's private polling and there's public polling and there's thousands of focus groups, all in a bid to understand what the hell voters are thinking. But As Ed Miliband learnt, what the polls tell you in the run-up to the election doesn't always chime with what actually happens.
But hang on a minute, they were wrong in 2017, and they were wrong in 2016, and they were wrong in 2015. So it wouldn't be all that shocking if they were wrong again.
I think in 2015, the polls proved pretty disastrously wrong. I think a lot of people in the polling industry are deeply scarred by that experience.
We're always one huge polling miss away from a crisis.
It's very easy to hold up a line of a poll and get it to say whatever you might want it to say.
From Politico, I'm Sasha O'Sullivan, and this week on Westminster Insider, I'm figuring out the secrets of the pollsters and asking, if the polls were wrong before, is it possible they could be wrong again?
This year, we meet as the opposition. Next year, the British people willing an end to 18 years of the Tories, and we will meet as the new Labour government of Britain.
Tony Blair, October 1996, Labour Party Conference. The hall in Blackpool could not contain its excitement. Members, MPs, staffers, and party faithful could all see they were now within spitting distance of Downing Street. The Tory government was on its knees, and every single opinion poll had Labour miles in front. But to secure victory, according to Tony Blair at least, they needed to win over one more crucial person, Mondeo Mann. Mondeo Mann, of course, wasn't just some guy Tony Blair could track down, bang on his door, and turn on the famous new Labour charm. He wasn't even, strictly, a man. Instead, he represented to the party a particular demographic. In Blair's own words, he'd bought his own house, set up a business, and now that he was doing nicely for himself, he'd decided to vote Tory.
The new look Ford Mondeo, one of the safest places to be.
To pollsters, Mondeo Mann was a shorthand. He was, in nerdy terms, a demographic segment of Britain, and a voter archetype with which elections could be won and lost. We've had countless others just like Mondeo Mann. On campaign trails through the years, we've met Worcester women, the Pebbledash people, we've exchanged pleasantries with net moms, Mr. Motorway, and even Mr. Bored and Ms. Distrustful. And brace yourselves, because at this election, we have a brand new one.
34 miles from Westminster, and you'll find Stevenage woman and the kind of voters that Jeremy Hunt needs to keep on side in this Tory seat.
She's a young woman, probably about 40, got a couple of kids, working but struggling financially to get by.
This is Josh Williams. He's the Director of Strategy at Labour Together, a left-wing think tank which works closely with Keir Starmer's leadership team. And he's one of the people who dreamt up Stevenage Woman.
She says absolutely nothing about politics, right? She talks about the things in her life that are affecting her, the fact that her energy bill is through the roof, the fact that her food shop was so expensive, but also, you know, the kind of things that we all talk about when we're not talking about politics. She talks about what she's seen on TV. She talks about what her kids are up to. What does she drink? Glass of white wine, but not a posh one. And if Labour or the Conservatives can win over Stevenage Woman, our argument is, then they win the election.
Now, I know, I can already hear you cringing. She sounds like pretty much everyone, right? But what's amazing is that the research that goes into creating profiles like Stevenage Woman has been a staple in almost every campaign since 1997.
Tony Blair's team imported that and it became the kind of Essex man, Mondeo man.
This is Tom Lubbock, co-founder of the polling firm JL Partners and a former pollster at CCHQ.
And at the heart of it is an attempt to try and understand that kind of voter that Tony Blair just woke up and knew all about every day, which is this kind of middle England voter, that person, I think, still exists.
In 2019, the importance of the middle England voter, the Mondeo man, was replaced with a new key demographic, Workington man. He was the one famous for bringing Boris Johnson to victory.
We want to unite and level up. We think that talent and genius is evenly distributed around the whole country. But we think
there are two really important voters. One of them is this character called Workington Man, often described as the Red Wall voter. They live in those seats throughout the Midlands and the North East and the North West. They're very economically left-wing. They're very socially conservative. And that voter is really quite different from the Stevenage woman. But we need to be thinking about both of those two voters if Labour is going to turn the next election.
People who run political campaigns find all this stuff invaluable. They genuinely believe it can help Westminster-based politicians connect with the types of ordinary people they actually represent.
The point of them is to bring to life for the politicians, for the practitioners in this process, who the people are that they're trying to talk to.
This is Andrew Cooper. He was David Cameron's director of strategy, and he worked as a pollster for the Conservative Party since the 1990s, all the way up to the Brexit vote.
Often your campaign will have a cutout of a person, and they'll give that person a name. And we round out that archetype. And when you're a politician and you're doing a TV interview, it's very helpful, it's very crystallising for you to actually have that picture of that person in mind.
Labour Together came up with the idea of Stevenage Woman back in April 2023 in the hopes of cementing this person in the mind of Keir Starmer. And they didn't just dream it up in the pub. A ton of work goes into this stuff.
It starts with a huge survey, and you ask tens of questions, maybe even hundreds of questions, on all sorts of different issues. So everything about your local area, your attitudes to every social issue that you can think of, you know, everything from immigration to transgender rights, you know, and then you do the same for economic attitudes. So what do you think about tax and spend? What do you think about nationalizing things? And then based on that, you start to see that groups emerge of people who share similar views.
The campaign chiefs then use this research to focus their messaging, and often their policies, on the groups of people they think they can win over from the other side. Here's Andrew Cooper.
Essentially, on the basis of all this information we've acquired, we've got a segment of 15% of people over there who are never, ever, ever, ever going to vote for us, whatever we do, which itself is a very helpful insight, so we can ignore them. On the other side, we've got a group of absolute true believers. Campaigns are about the people in the middle. They're about the biddable people. Both sides will essentially have done the same exercise. So we've all identified the people in the middle, and we're all trying to get them.
All of this means that when politicians stand up in a campaign or go on the Sunday morning TV round, they're trying, literally, to talk to you. No, really, I mean you.
The Obama campaign in 2012, which was a real kind of breakthrough in campaign sort of technique, started with the really brilliantly simple observation that a perfect campaign would be one in which you would have a completely individualised conversation with every individual voter.
All right, this is the fun part. We got some time for questions and answers. These questions have not been pre-screened or predetermined.
Now, you can't obviously do that, but actually you can get surprisingly close to it. You can then go to an individual targeting level, so actually we can find the few tens of thousands of voters in the few dozens of constituencies who actually matter, and you wouldn't want to be that person because you're on the receiving end of torrents of direct targeted messaging, very tailored, very personalised, using sophisticated data analytics to tailor the message.
When it came to 2015, right back where we started on this episode, David Cameron used micro-targeting with a masterful efficacy, pulling a 12-seat majority out of the bag. Andrew Cooper was in his element.
In 2015, the Conservative Party, we started off, I think, with 8 segments, and then that we split that down into 2 target groups. And then you keep applying other filters to it. So by the time the campaign actually started, it was 8 subgroups, and by the time it finished, there were 13. There would be literally hundreds of different versions of the same piece of communication So you're splitting into your 13 subtypes, and then there'll be some people who get that only over email, some people get it in the post, some people get it on a leaflet, some people it will be part of a script that's delivered on their doorstep.
The other parties might not care about this part of the world, but £7.2 billion is going into transport into the southwest if I'm your Prime Minister.
All the polls said it was going to be a hung parliament. The Conservatives won a majority, partly because it was very, very targeted campaigning, and nobody knew it was happening. They hyper-targeted people who had voted Liberal Democrat in 2010, and even the Liberal Democrats, who are brilliant at local campaigning, didn't realise it was happening to them. And Craig Oliver, my colleague, who was communications director then, amuses him to note that in that campaign, lots of the lobby and the press pack following Cameron used to complain about the fact we're going, why are we going to Cornwall again? Why are we going to Devon again? Over and over again. We're sick and tired of it, but didn't ever ask themselves the questions, why do these people keep going back to Cornwall and Devon? To which the answer was, that's where the Liberal Democrat MPs are.
It is, of course, too early to give a considered account of why we have suffered the catastrophic losses we have, and the party will have to reflect on these in the time ahead.
On the Labour side of the 2015 campaign, they were apparently not even looking at the right numbers.
There was very limited polling budget in that race. The poll I did do showed the race getting closer.
This is Stan Greenberg. He was Labour's pollster from the 1995 era of Tony Blair right through to Ed Miliband. He's kind of a legend in polling. He was even the numbers guy for Nelson Mandela. And he's the guy credited with importing voter archetypes from the US, where he worked as Bill Clinton's polling guru. I'm speaking to him from his office in Washington, D.C., over Zoom. So forgive the slightly fuzzy audio.
I recommended that we do more polling because that would impact where we put our resources and campaign.
Pretty much every single poll had Labour in the lead. But because this was largely based on the available public polling, rather than any special private polling commissioned by Miliband's campaign team, they just had to kind of trust what was out there. And trust it, they did.
Now, our six pledges form the basis of our plan for working people. These six pledges are now carved in stone.
All the polling had it as a race that we could end up as the government. And that was the assumption we had. You know, they were drafting two speeches. I was involved in the drafting of the speeches and couldn't get myself involved in the concession speech. So, yes, we were leaning into us winning and forming the government.
Worse still, not everyone in Miliband's top team was given access to what little private polling the campaign had undertaken. Come election day, this had grim consequences for Labour.
I made the assumption that everybody was seeing the polls. It turned out it was a narrow group that saw the polls, and a lot of anger, you know, after where, you know, seats that we lost that where people would have gone to campaign, you know, including the shadow chancellor, Ed Balls, who was upset that he didn't know that we had a poll that showed the race getting closer. So our polls were showing it shifting, and we didn't have polls right at the end.
And of course, Ed Balls lost his seat.
Let me start by saying to my political opponents, congratulations, and in particular, the new MP for Morley and Outwood, Andrea Jenkins. Andrea, you have fought a really...
1 year after the 2015 election came the EU referendum.
The only way we get control is to vote to leave the European Union. And I think William Hague...
And here too, the polling was highly contentious. Now, Andrew Cooper was the pollster for the Remain camp. And he insists that 6 weeks before the vote, he could see things were going in the wrong direction. But within the hallowed halls of the Stronger In camp, changing strategy at that point would look chaotic.
So I think the weight of evidence is on the side of remaining to keep our economy strong and to keep Britain's families...
And yet, literally, on the day of the referendum, there were two private polls done on each side of the vote. One from Andrew Cooper, which showed Remain leading on 51.9%. Another poll from Aaron Banks, the sugar daddy of leave.eu, showed, you guessed it, 48-52 to leave. 8 years later, we're all still asking, how did Remain get it so wrong?
By the final 2 or 3 months of the campaign, we're polling every day. and we're asking, how are you going to vote? Oh, that's not what we're really looking at. What we're really looking at, we will have done the analytics to understand the underlying issues, that the kind of binary questions that are driving your answer to the question, am I going to vote to remain or to leave? And what we are tracking was that. So the things we need to focus on, hold those on the remain side of the argument. And what we saw in the tracking through the campaign was those things steadily moving to the left as we looked at them. So things which started off being quite strongly associated with remain started to shift across. So it was, we could see that we were losing the underlying argument.
What's clear is that the polling disasters of 2015 and 2016 changed the way pollsters operated in this country for good. For some, like Andrew Cooper, he abandoned measuring headline voting intention altogether. Many swapped completely to online polling, with the idea that you can reach more people and therefore get a more accurate sample. For others, they put their energies into a new beast altogether. And what they came up with post-2016 was the multi-level regression and post-stratification poll, or, as is commonly and more easily known, MRP.
MRP is a bigger sample, but also the way you deliver the methodology seems, on the face of it, a better quality piece of research.
This is Nadeem Zahawi. He co-founded YouGov in 2000. Since then, he's been a Tory MP, Conservative Party chair, Education Secretary, and even, for about 2 minutes, the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
In the old days, there were some people who thought that, you know, polling was the business of scientific measurement by face-to-face or telephone. Our hypothesis is that we're all in the business of modelling.
MRP polls are also hugely expensive. These are massive surveys, tens of thousands of people. Many times the sample size of a regular poll. The pollsters take the results and map them across the country using demographic data about where different types of voters actually live. This allows them to make predictions about which party is going to win each of the 650 constituencies across the country. Which, of course, is how Britain's first-past-the-post electoral system actually works. The first time MRP polls hit the headlines was a survey by YouGov in the 2017 snap election. Remember that? It was the only poll to forecast the truly shocking end result. A surge of support for Jeremy Corbyn. And a hung parliament.
It's a new way of projecting the result. YouGov makes very clear that there's a very wide range. The number we have in the Times, 310, is the midpoint of the range.
At the time, plenty of people questioned the new methodology. But after the exit poll dropped, YouGov were hailed as heroes.
Stunning results, so let's just leave it up for a moment to take it in. The Conservatives on 314, that leaves them, if it is correct, considerably short of a majority.
Recently, another MRP poll made headlines, paid for by the Conservative Britain Alliance, a shadowy organisation which is no fan of the Prime Minister. It caused waves of anguish in Tory HQ when it predicted a Labour landslide, and the Tories whittled down to just 169 seats. But even with a big MRP poll, the usual caveats remain. When The Telegraph published the findings across its front page, Isaac Levito, Rishi Sunak's campaign strategist, told Tory MPs it's just a poll. There will be thousands of other polls.
I just don't think we should get hung up. Sometimes what happens is the industry picks up on these sort of brands, you know, MRP, and then everybody is talking about, well, we have to have the MRP sample. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. But that's not the only thing you can do in terms of understanding public opinion.
I always look at the average of the polls.
Tony Blair's pollster, Stan Greenberg, again.
And I'm assuming, you know, most of the press, even when they have their own polls, you know, look at the average of the polls, you know, to have a better sense of, you know, where the race really is.
Even if you aren't doing these mammoth MRP surveys, since 2015, the way pollsters study the electorate has changed dramatically. And they say, for the better.
Right now, the biggest change is the move to mobile phones and then the move to internet. And I mean, what that means is that you can actually do much more. The polling is more accurate, believe it or not.
Many pollsters use a method called in-flight polling. This means literally catching people on the fly. Sometimes you might come across these in place of an ad on YouTube or your social media vortex of choice.
As pollsters, we are all in a constant battle for accuracy.
Tom Lubbock of polling firm JL Partners again.
One of the best places to reach people for shorter polls, for quick polls, reach people who you might not otherwise be able to reach and who definitely wouldn't pick up the phone if you just call their mobile or landline, is to catch people while they're using apps or shopping online.
But however you get the data, the basics remain the same. Get the views of 1,000 people and then extrapolate that across the wider population.
And any time we go on the radio or on TV and say, you know, here's what our poll says, I guarantee you the first comment that you'll get on social media is, well, you didn't ask me, you didn't ask any of my friends, you only asked 1,000 people. How do you know that's what the public in the UK thinks? And the simple answer is there's a bit of maths that tells you that if you randomly ask 1,000 people, you get within about 3 percentage points of any large population. So 60, 70 million in the UK, if you ask 1,000 people at random, you'll get within about 3 percentage points of the answer if you've done it right.
Now, sometimes public scepticism about polling is well-founded because politicians just love to wave polls above their heads as beacons of proof of, well, whatever they want.
It's very easy to hold up a line of a poll and get it to say whatever you might want it to say.
This is Scarlett Maguire, a former TV news producer who now works with Tom Lubbock at JL Partners. She's talking about the recent Reform UK press conference led by its leader, Richard Tice.
Good morning, everybody. Very good to see you this Monday morning. Thanks for being here.
Now, Richard Tice at one point said, voters need to know that a vote cast for Rishi Sunak is a vote cast for Keir Starmer, whereas a vote cast for Reform is a vote cast for the Reform Party. And the obvious implication, I think he was trying to say, is that a vote on Tories will be a wasted vote. All you'll be doing is letting Keir Starmer in. We have a better chance of beating Labour in all these seats. I think that was the implication. Now, that is incredibly misleading.
Britain is broken, and we all know who broke it.
Now, to be clear, like anyone, I love a good poll. But they're really only half of the equation. That's right. After the break, we're talking focus groups.
And there was one focus group and two of the participants met one another. They went, oh my God, we used to date each other 25 years ago. Well, I was like hoping this was going to be the focus group rom-com.
Stay with us.
Little did I know that one of Labour's most senior politicians, David Lammy, was such a fan of Margaret Thatcher.
I accept that while she comes from a different tradition, of course Margaret Thatcher was a visionary leader for the UK. No doubt about it. That's absolutely clear.
I'm Anne McElvoy, and my guest this week on Politico's transatlantic podcast, Power Play, has his eye on the job that brings the grandest office in Whitehall.
I haven't lost my bark, and it's never gone. It'll always be there.
Do have a listen to the full interview on Politico's Power Play podcast on all major platforms.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm going to go around and just ask you to tell me where you're from, what you do during the day to keep busy.
Westminster loves to bang on about focus groups. They're the yin to the opinion poll yang. At the beginning of every focus group, there's this moment. No one knows yet why they're there. No one knows each other. And they're all sat around a table, or in some cases, on a Zoom link, awkwardly eyeing up the snacks and unsure how to begin. All the pollsters said something like, it's a fundamentally weird setting. You get 6 or 8 random people sitting in a circle in a small room, answering questions about the issues of the day. The art of it is to try to make people comfortable, to get people to tell the truth, and to not make them think they're in a classroom being schooled by some Westminster know-it-all.
Just ask you to tell me, most importantly, the best thing that you've watched on TV recently.
I went to multiple focus groups with voters from around the country, from the outskirts of Birmingham to Blyth in the northeast of England. The demographics were different, the gender balance was different, but this early, awkward discomfort remained exactly the same. Most people recruited for a focus group never know in advance what they're coming to talk about. Of course, they quickly cotton on to the fact we're talking politics. But apparently, many of them don't really care or ask what party the focus group is for. They're here to collect the 50 or 80 quid they've been promised in exchange for giving their, well, vibes.
They're coming because they get this incentive and it means that you get a broader pool of people.
This is Luke Trill, the director of the More in Common Research Group and the pollster leading one of the focus groups I went to.
Lots of people think that the important thing about a focus group is in the moderation when you're in the group. It starts way before that, because the first question you've got to ask yourself is, who do I want in the focus group? Do you want people who voted Conservative for the first time in 2019 to see if they regret their switch? Do you want, as we had in Blyth, a women-only group?
The fact we were talking to 8 women in Blyth was no accident. As with all focus groups, it's a matter of careful demographic research beforehand.
We went to Blyth because, of course, it was one of those so-called red wall seats that fell in the last election. We ran it as an all-female group because we know that the group who have gone from Conservative to Don't Know are very heavily female, 60 to 70% of Conservative to Don't Know female. We wanted to mimic that in their group.
All these people know about each other is their rough ages, their jobs, and their favourite television programmes. They got off to a tentative start, but then they really laid in.
Do you know what? It depends what they're taking out of the country if they're not putting anything in and everybody else is.
So I just think they're going to lie about where the money goes in any case.
It doesn't make a huge amount of difference. Knowing what it goes on, I would rather it went on schools and things.
You've got to know when to probe and when to back off. The power of silence. You know, sometimes you can be tempted to jump in, but actually, sort of sometimes it's worthwhile just letting things rest. I wonder, still thinking about the government and the man in charge, Rishi Sunak, do you think he's doing a good job at the moment as Prime Minister?
I would say no. He seems to make promises and then 5 seconds later he seems to have broke those promises.
He's just another politician that you don't know whether to trust or not.
I think they almost need like a new party, like, because the Conservatives are too one way and Labour are too the other way.
I mean, I don't trust politicians anyway because I feel like they just tell you what they want to hear until they're actually in power.
This scepticism, this disinterest from Westminster politics is something that comes up again and again in focus groups, but not necessarily something that gets picked up in polling.
people, by and large, are very poor predictors of their own likelihood to vote.
Andrew Cooper again.
So the traditional way of doing it was to say on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 means you're absolutely certain to vote and 0 means you definitely won't vote, how likely are you to vote? And people give an answer to that question. If you then look at callback polls after the election and look at what people said before and whether they voted afterwards, there's no relation at all.
The focus group in Blythe was held the day before the spring budget that Chancellor Jeremy Hunt unveiled on March the 6th.
What was so interesting, I felt, about that group, I thought it was a sort of classic example of, you know, we have in our head this view of budgets as sort of big game-changing events, and yet that wasn't what this group felt at all. There was this sense that, oh, you know, is it going to change that much? There was a real cynicism.
There was a Morton statement last November. Can any of you remember what the Chancellor announced at that?
No, I can't remember what was said now. Was it the national insurance, when the national insurance went down?
It was this year. Have any of you noticed that?
No.
This disengagement was echoed almost exactly in two other focus groups when I tagged along with Josh Williams and his colleagues from Labour Together, the think tank behind Stevenage Woman.
We are going to sit behind a plate glass two-way mirror and watch a group of voters talking about politics, and we're going to hear the things that they are concerned about and potentially what might push them one way or another at the next election.
Sadly, I wasn't allowed to record this focus group, but I did get to watch Andrew Cooper in action. Yep, that's right. The guy who used to do polling for David Cameron has now swapped teams and is working with Josh Williams and others at Labour Together. Leading the group, he's softly spoken. He doesn't dominate. They played the group of men and women, varying in age from their mid-20s to mid-50s, different clips of Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak.
What we really wanted to get was that it was a clip of Keir Starmer talking about the five missions that he says will frame his government and a clip of Rishi Sunak explaining his kind of economic plan. And what we want to know is, did it make sense to you? Did you understand it?
Now, it's important to say at the outset, Labour Together and Andrew Cooper are very much party political. But they are literally there to test how Starmer goes down with the public.
I thought the interesting thing about the groups that we went to is that their analysis of the situation was very similar. They all felt like they were very let down by the government. They all felt like their local area was in a bad state. They all certainly gave a lot of blame to the Conservatives after 14 years. What you then saw, I think, was differing degrees of how much they were ready to accept change to Labour. So there was a very strong case for we want change right now in both of the groups that we saw. And then there was really quite a stark difference between those groups about how much they were willing to embrace Labour as that change.
And this is where focus groups help inform polling. Given the two leaders on a surface-level question of who they prefer, they chose Starmer, almost every time. But drill into that, and there was still a real distrust. People were saying all the things we've heard. It's time for change. But this distrust cuts through to both parties. And people, at least in these groups, were willing to hear what Starmer had to say. But they needed more.
So I think the second of the two groups we went to, you basically had everybody in the room saying, yeah, time for change and time for change to Labour. In the first group, you had much more hesitancy around time to change to Labour. And I think that plays out in the polls that you see as well. Yeah, you've got a really big shift from the Conservatives to the Labour Party. Yes, you've got the Labour Party with really big leads. You've also got a lot of voters who say, I don't know. Or you've got a lot of voters who are telling pollsters that they've switched from the Tories to Labour, but actually they're still pretty unsure about where they're going to go on the day.
So you take all this information, you've compiled focus groups, polling, surveys. What's the idea? How does this help the Labour Party?
Well, we're doing this. You know, the Labour Party themselves are doing this constantly as well. The closer you get to the election, it's about refining the policy. So it's about thinking about, okay, if we're going to do something like GB Energy, right? We're going to make big investments in Britain's renewable energy industry. focus groups like this are going to make you think, okay, well, what are the ways that we make sure that this most immediately affects the voters who are crucially important in the next election? Whether that's something like, how are we going to ensure that it brings down their energy bills as quickly as possible?
People like Nadeem Zahawi, the Tory MP who helped set up YouGov, take umbrage at the use of focus groups in this way. It was Barack Obama who told Gordon Brown that good policy is good politics. You shouldn't need a focus group to tell you if something is the right thing to do.
Polling is like a tap, right? Running water, where you can literally get a sense of where the nation is at very quickly. That's sensible. That's a good thing, because that's your sort of radar screen. You'd be mad not to, as a political movement, not to have a sort of constant radar picking up how people are feeling, what they're thinking. And then separate to that is policy formation. You know, that should not be sort of driven by, you know, asking people what they really want. It actually should be driven by looking at the evidence and saying, this is what we need to do to create a better, you know, society, a better community, better economy, all the other things. And here's why. And once you've come up with the ideas, you can then use polling to try and communicate them as well as you can.
This is where focus groups really come into their own. They can build on existing polling about different policies and help politicians make sure they're communicated in ways which actually appeal to the general public.
Sometimes, though, when you get into a campaign, you do get slogans that just come straight out of a focus group.
Josh Williams again.
So the 2019 election famously has "Get Brexit Done." I obviously wasn't in those focus groups, but I have heard and I fully believe that "Get Brexit Done" was the kind of thing that people were saying over and over again. And so a slogan sort of bubbles up. It's not necessarily a bad thing that that happens. It's a bad thing if you get a slogan that bubbles up and it's not something that you ever intend to do, but you think, huh, if I just say this, then maybe I'll, you know, hoodwink people and win.
Now, there is, of course, the massive caveat that every focus group is only ever the opinions of 6 or 8 people sitting in a room. Anyone in the job of figuring out what the British public think and want from their politicians will tell you the best way is a combination of polls and focus groups.
So, for instance, you might get back, as we have in a poll, this feeling that Keir Starmer is out of touch. Why do people think Keir Starmer is out of touch? We ran a series of focus groups, and what kept on coming out was this fact that it was Sir Keir Starmer. It was the knighthood was an issue for people. And it became clear from the focus group that people thought it was a hereditary title that Keir Starmer had. They thought he'd inherited the knighthood. And that was what was making people think he was kind of out of touch because he was a member of the landed gentry. Again, it would be so hard to get that from just a poll.
Occasionally, the pollsters bring politicians to come and watch focus groups for themselves. The results can be spectacular, as Andrew Cooper explains.
The absolute bottom line is we think verbatim quotes are really, really good way to bring it to life. We would always, always try to persuade the politicians to come and observe because it's just such a great reality check. We didn't often succeed. I mean, generally speaking, they are simply stunned at how little people know and how little attention they're paying. I was once with the then Shadow Home Secretary. This was Chris Grayling. He came to observe some focus groups, and he'd been on doing the sort of weekend media round all weekend, and the groups were on a Monday. He insisted on being brought in sort of through the back door because people would, you know, didn't want people to mob him, and then he sat down. He expected them to sort of know all about him. So we started and said, sort of, you know, what have you heard any Conservative politicians saying lately? Nothing, nothing. Then, you know, can anyone name any leading members of the Shadow Cabinet? Nothing. Do you know who the Shadow Home Secretary is? Nothing. Do you know who Chris Grayling is? Nothing. And he's like heartbroken.
Poor Chris Grayling. And then, of course, there were times when the politicians became, shall we say, impatient, sitting behind the one-way glass.
Focus group which Theresa May was watching, which we were doing in Windsor, and it had some of her constituents from Maidenhead in the room, and they were talking about her as a local MP, and people were asserting with great confidence in the way that they do that she didn't live in the constituency and was never active and she didn't hold surgeries, and she came bursting into the room and started arguing with them. saying that's completely wrong. What you said in that, completely wrong. This is where I live, and I do this and this. And that. She wasn't sort of rude or anything about it, but she just wasn't. She wasn't having it. It was just very funny.
Theresa May, always surprising us, whether it's in focus groups or fields of wheat. What is perhaps less surprising is the media's sometimes superficial cherry-picking of polling.
I think there's always a temptation with journalism when people ask you what's going to happen to pretend that you're better at crystal balling than you actually are.
This is Rachel Cunliffe. She's Associate Political Editor at The New Statesman.
Polls provide data, and data means that it's not just your opinion you're writing about. A lot of journalists have humanities degrees and are good at essays and are good at arguments, but always felt a little bit like we weren't very good at science and maths, and polling gives us an opportunity to look like we've got the facts at our disposal when we actually don't.
And of course, there's the kind of poll which provides political dynamite for Westminster types to seize upon.
There's a tendency to accept at face value the headline figures of the polls rather than looking at what the poll was actually asking. And we had a really great example of this at the start of the year, where The Telegraph ran this big YouGov poll that showed support for Keir Starmer versus Rishi Sunak. And unsurprisingly, Keir Starmer was way ahead of Rishi Sunak in virtually every constituency in the country. But then they ran a separate question, which is Keir Starmer versus a different new Conservative Prime Minister. And The Telegraph took this as proof that if the Conservatives replaced their leader, they could do significantly better in various parts of the country. If you look at what YouGov actually asked, this anonymous new Conservative leader would be one who cut taxes, got NHS waiting lists down, reduced immigration.
These kinds of polls can shape a narrative around an election, whether or not they are accurate. Here's Stan Greenberg again.
In the US, if you look at, you know, what happened in the midterm elections, Democrats did better than people expected. Now, I can tell you the campaign polling was accurate. Campaign polling showed no move to the Republicans at the end. The public polls were showing movement. And what you have is kind of partisan, in this case, conservative organizations that were kind of flooding the public with polls that gave the impression that the election was getting tighter and tighter at the end. But it had a real impact. It meant that Republicans shifted money to races, you know, that they shouldn't have. And Democrats who were safe actually had suddenly found there were floods of money, you know, pouring in.
Right now, everyone in polling, and I mean everyone, has become slightly obsessed with where those people who voted Conservative for the first time in 2019 will go this time around. Because the truth is, the British electorate never looked more volatile. The number of don't knows is at 17%, and the number of people who vote consistently for a particular party is at an all-time low.
The beauty of being a political pollster in the UK is, for the most part, the public are quite flexible.
Tom Lubbock again.
They're quite homogenous, but also they're willing to give a new prime minister or another party or a new view the time of day.
Could the polls be wrong?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
I think they probably are wrong.
Andrew Cooper.
In the UK, when polls are wrong at elections, they have always been wrong in the same direction. They have always overstated Labour and understated the Conservatives, because underlying demographics of the sort of core votes of those parties means that people who tend to vote Conservative tend to be more time poor, harder to get hold of and less willing to participate. And that's hard to correct for.
The question of what will happen with undecided voters, I think, is potentially the biggest one.
Scarlett Maguire.
We think that the Conservatives will need half, at least, of undecided voters to break for them in order to be in any way competitive.
Voting behaviour, particularly in recent years, has become incredibly volatile.
Josh Williams.
And so you have to do much more of this stuff, because you can find yourself caught out if you don't, thinking that what people thought a month ago is what they think today.
There will be lots of Conservatives who will hear this over the next few months, both from party strategists and from the Prime Minister.
They will be hoping they can pull a miraculous rabbit out of the hat, that the economic situation will suddenly look up, that the sins of the last few years will be wiped away by some kind of newfound buoyancy. But even if the polls are wrong, even if all this work and all this research and all these focus groups have fallen into the trap Andrew Cooper talks about of overstating a Labour lead, the way we measure how Britain votes has fundamentally changed. One of the things the pollsters told me about again and again was this surge of distrust, of disillusionment with politics and the media. How all of this factors in to the volatility of the polls and how we actually vote come election day has yet to materialise. We'll only know for sure when the 10 p.m. exit poll finally drops. Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider with me, Sasha O'Sullivan. If you've enjoyed it, please spread the word, follow us, and maybe leave us a nice review. And please don't forget, you can go back and listen to old episodes, like Aggie's from season 12 on how to prepare for government. My producer this week was John Rogers of Whistledown Productions. And here at Politico, my executive producer is Christina Gonzalez, and my editor is Jack Blanchard. That's it now for season 13. But fear not, the podcast will be back later in the spring after a few weeks' break. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.